That's right. We are starting again. Like, it's just interesting right there on everyday life to observe what happens when one is, let's say, late or coming back and might be watched coming into a room. Selfing arises. Or one thinks alternately, I'm here, how come they're walking in late? And whatever. You know, all these little moments. Family life is fantastic for mindfulness of selfing, right? Because you can just see it coming and going, rising and falling, based on all these triggers or events. So it's a very, very fertile field for practice. Okay, I should get my microphone up here. All right, great. Okay, so let's get going, and we'll head toward another practice in a bit. I want to show you a few more slides, and then we'll open up for conversation again. So here we have self is like a unicorn. Now, that said, and by the way, this is worth these two very, very developed people, obviously, said what I tried to say in my previous slide more profoundly, which is to say, when we get in touch with not self or selflessness, it's not like we make something go away. More exactly, we see through an illusion. In other words, we recognize that that to which those representations point, or that who is implicit in those self-related activations, is a mythical beast. All right? In other words, we increasingly recognize that to which we have ascribed selfhood actually doesn't have selfhood at all. And so then, all that said, rebellious yogi that I am, I said, yeah, but what about the way the self is useful? For example, let me give you a little thought experiment. Which would you rather have your sweetie say to you? A, you know, there is so much love arising here in this sort of indeterminate space that's being occupied by that body and this one. Or would you rather have your sweetie say, I love you? Which would you rather hear? You know, good things will happen, or I'm going to protect you no matter what. Which would you rather hear? Right? There are times in life where identification with the body is useful. I was talking with somebody at the break, you know, getting down out of the mountains, out of a messy situation, intact. Holy moly, there's a fair amount of selfhood arising. A lot of Rick is there, you know, when the hammer goes down. Mess with my kids. Wow. You want to meet Rick real fast? Mess with my kids. You know, there's a place, and I think you want a dad. You know what I mean? You're like, don't mess with my kids. And mom as well, obviously, a parent. So there is a place for selfing. Right? Just like there's a place for cognizing, there's a place for sensing, there's a place for seeing, there's a place for wholesome wanting. The wish that others be happy is a wholesome wish. The wish that one be awakened or progress on the path of awakening is a wholesome wish. There's a place for these things. I think also it's interesting to just consider about how the sense of the other co-evolved with the sense of the self. In that, in evolution, different functions evolve, and they don't evolve unless there's a complementary benefit. For example, the evolution of increasing precision, of motor control, of speech sounds, which based on the evolution or mutation, actually, of a gene called the FOXP gene that seems to have happened about 60,000 or so years ago while we were still modern humans genetically. That was Cro-Magnon man, Cro-Magnon woman, and on, around 150,000 years worth. Well, around 60,000 or so years ago, this mutation occurred in the motor cortex in the brainstem that controls fine speech sounds, which enabled us to produce speech with much more dexterity and precision than any other animal on the planet can produce vocalizations. Right? There's no sense in that mutation being conserved, because everybody has about 3 to 4 mutations in their DNA. Right now, you have 3 to 4 mutations. Most of them are irrelevant. Another little detail in evolution, how many of you have blue or green eyes? Raise them high, come on, don't be afraid. You are mutants. There was no one like you 5,000 years ago. Just about 5,000 years ago, somewhere around Copenhagen, some little boy, some little girl was born with bright blue eyes. And that mutation was conserved because of various reasons. Who knows? Minimally, they look different, right? Evolution is still ongoing. The point is that in terms of producing, or my example here, producing speech sounds, there's no sense in being able to produce dexterous sounds which then map to a greater elaboration of meanings, which is another example of how meanings are supported by some underlying material substrate. Okay? The meanings of languaging, greater elaboration of meanings being supported by a greater complexity of speech sounds, which is to say a greater complexity of various wavelengths moving through the air, you know, in terms of sound waves, right? There's no sense in being able to transmit more precisely and more meaningfully if there is not a receiver there. And so it seems that what happened is that language comprehension evolved with growing dexterity and precision and complexity of language production. Similarly, there's no sense in evolving a growing sense of self without there being some growing sense of the other who is apprehending the self, right? And so I think relationships, it's very hard to have a much sense of relationship, particularly in ordinary human development, without a sense of self. I think it's partly through developing a sense of self in early childhood and adolescence that then people form their relationships, which create another potential stage of development, and not everyone enters it. We won't talk about the previous occupants of the White House. But anyway, in which there is a growing capacity to transcend self. As someone quoted Jack Engler to me earlier, you need to become somebody in order to become nobody. Right? And by the way, as also someone said to me at the break, really usefully, just to be clear on the language, by self, I mean, that's a synonym for me with ego. Okay, I think egoity, you know, conceit, narcissism is a self-related activity, but the general noun ego, for me that's synonymous with self. I think Freud's notion of ego, you know, the subject to whom the id and the superego seem like objects, right, that's tantamount to self in the way I'm using it. Not the capital S self, or the transcendental self, but I'm talking about the lowercase s self. All right? Okay, great. So, long story short, self has been stitched into human DNA across 100,000 generations at least since our earliest ancestors began making stone tools 2.5 million years ago. They had brains about a third our size. The brain has tripled in size over the last 3 million years. And arguably, most of that tripling has had to do with self and relational functions, like language, cooperative planning, empathy, altruism, tuning into others, the presentation of self, deception, concerns about reputation, increasing social skills, work in the alpha, beta, you know, dynamic. To put it really bluntly, finding ways to still get laid if you're beta, right? Which is very important if you're passing on your genes and there's only one or two alpha and there are a bunch of others in the tribe. A lot of studies of primates show that betas, trying to look for a less coarse expression, betas get about as much action as alphas, but they have to be a lot more clever. In a funny kind of way, you got to have more on the ball to be a beta and pass on your genes. So for those of us that have felt like beta in junior high, you know, revenge of the nerds. But anyway, moving right along. Okay.
We drive evolution.
That's it. That's it. We rock. Okay, so one more. That said, even though self does have its uses, selfing leads to suffering. I mean, Bill really wonderfully elaborated that. When I, me, or mine are mental objects like any other, just another eddy in the stream, is not a problem, right? We can consider them as just another content coming and going, just like pain does not need to be a problem. desire does not need to be a problem when it's held in open spaciousness with some equanimity. Selfing, as it arises, does not need to be a problem if there is disenchantment that leads to equanimity related to selfing. But ordinary selfing, in other words, the conventional mind that privileges self-representations, that identifies with them, that wants to glorify the self, look really great, you know, as soon as we start there, whamola, suffering begins. The trick, I think, is to dexterously be able to work with these eddies in ways that are skillful without being bound by them or swept along by them or identified with them. And that's the art of practice. And it's an ongoing art. It's a wonderful process. You know, it can be a long and very fruitful one.
May I say something?
Yeah, please, always. Yeah.
One of the ways that I like to talk about this in my class is, you all know what pink elephants are? Mm-hmm. Right? I think, who is it? Dumbo, who has pink elephants in the cartoon? Well, if self is a unicorn, or perhaps like a pink elephant, is the way to get rid of this self to fight and try and kill those pink elephants?
Wonderful.
Is that going to be worth doing? Mm-hmm. You don't have to fight against it. You just see it as the hallucination that it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great. The useful fiction. I love that pink elephant. I'll use it. Thank you. I'll try to remember that you thought of it, but I may not. Notice how you feel about that.
I own it.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. All right. Okay, so now, now this is the bad news. That's the extent of the bad news. Okay. Bill and I, you know, Buddhism, doom and gloom, right? Okay. Now let's start talking about the good news. How in the world do we turn the corner? How in the world do we work with this genetically derived, stitched into human DNA, you know, evolutionarily adaptive, highly socially constructed, intensely rewarded, very intractable sense of me, myself, and I? What do we do about that? So now it's kind of turned more and more in that direction. So first of all, paradoxically, isn't it interesting that it really helps? You got to be a somebody before you develop into a nobody. In other words, if you feel, if one feels somewhat fractured as a somebody, it's really tough to become a nobody. Or if one lacked normal developmental support. Oh, sorry. Notice selfing right now. You don't have the slide. I apologize, although I went away and just did this at lunch. Because then I dropped in some more slides at lunch, including one I just made up right here. Bill kind of inspired me. So if you'll forgive me, I'm going to add some material. By the way, if you'd like, I'd like to collect your email addresses. I won't share them with anyone. And send you this slide set, which you're welcome to play around with or share with others. I appreciate attribution, but it's really OK. And you'll get the larger set. And I'll, just as a sidebar, I'll automatically subscribe you to the WiseBrain Bulletin, which comes out monthly from our institute, and my weekly newsletter, Just One Thing, if you're not already subscribed, unless you make a little notation next to your email address, do not subscribe me, in which case I won't. And you can always unsubscribe from either or both of those bulletins or newsletters whenever you want. So before we end here, or when we do end, I'll just kind of make my, actually I'll start maybe passing around. Does anybody have a pad they could pass around, this blank or not? If you don't, or do you? Just the pad itself? You willing to? And then we could, tell you what, here. Good. And just attach it, if you don't mind, and print neatly. We always have a problem with someone's address. Print your email address especially neatly. Okay, thank you. All right, moving on. So you don't have the slide. Here it is. I just put up there two ways to nurture a person in a way that helps self-release. Okay, one is through self-compassion. Self-compassion is a really, really important area of research. A lot of the benefits seemingly in psychological research on self-esteem boils down to self-compassion. I think in part because it's somewhere felt. It's really embodied. If self-compassion is a difficulty for a person, and for many people it actually is, these are some neurologically clever four steps that help light up the circuits, that kind of warm up the circuitry of self-compassion. One, bring to mind the felt sense of being with someone who loves you. Two, extend compassion to someone that naturally evokes it in you. 3, be mindful of and kind of sink into the experience of compassion itself. So there's a muscle memory of it, if you will. There's an emotional memory. It's quite embodied and sensate. And then direct it to yourself. I could have added a 5th step. Direct it to yourself at a time, maybe when you were young, or in a situation that naturally evokes compassion out of you, or from you rather, naturally evokes your compassion toward yourself, and then open out into compassion for yourself here and now. But I kind of collapsed those into the last step. What was that laugh about?
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's no problem.
I just read
Vegetables when they're present. You just read, oh, I got it. That's right. No worries at all. Okay, so that's self-compassion. Very important thing. If you work with people, I've found that this practice, including in those little steps there, is really quite useful. And as a general practice, it's quite useful in life. For myself, my own personal quickie first aid when things happen is pause, self-compassion, get on my own side, make a plan. And those usually happen in less than 10 seconds with some automaticity, but they're good first aid. Pause, self-compassion, which is simply the wish that one not suffer, combined with the attitude of sympathetic concern. That's what compassion is. Right? If kindness is the wish that beings be happy, compassion is the wish that they not suffer. We're simply applying that wish and that stance of tender sympathetic concern to the being of all among all beings who wears your name tag. Another, and by the way, I'm just doing this kind of quickly. I'll slow down when I get to some other material in a moment. I just want to mention these things in passing because I think they're quite important. The second one that's quite interesting is the idea of deliberately taking in what in psychology are called narcissistic supplies in order to heal narcissism or narcissistic injury. And to use the Buddha's metaphor, one faces a river of suffering to get across, one builds a raft. One gets across with a skillfully constructed raft, but on the other side of the stream, one doesn't keep carrying the raft around on one's head. One lays the methods down when one has moved beyond them. Same way, this second set here of taking in narcissistic supplies, one deliberately, there's a distinction that's critical between craving them and clinging to them, giving my fix of approval, prizing, or attunement. Good for 10 minutes or 10 hours or 10 days, then I need another fix. That's really different from helping oneself really internalize the supply. So it gradually fills the hole in the heart, and there is therefore less craving and clinging or suffering related to the vicissitudes of those, supplies in one's world. So, for example, how to do it, this goes to the taking in the good process, which is the 4th chapter in my book, and it's on my website and stuff like that. But to first let the good fact become a good experience. In other words, if someone is tuned into you or appreciates you or loves you or values you or praises you, whatever, let it be felt. Notice how often something good happens and we move on really fast. We don't register it. The needle doesn't move. We don't let it become an experience. Step one, let it become an experience. Based on intention. In other words, I'm helping the world by helping myself, feel better about me. Me in the broadest sense of person. I'm taking in supplies that this social animal, this person really, really needs. We need narcissistic supplies in healthy development. And most of us, I ballpark 90-95% of us had a significant shortfall or wounding related to optimal development of the felt sense of being loved and prized and tuned into. All right? Second step of taking in the good, really savor the experience, extend it in the body, let it become more intense as one can, and make it last. Neurons that fire together wire together. They do so very mechanically. The more of them that fire, the longer they fire, and the more distributed, and the more intensively, rather, they fire, the more they wire together. Okay. Third step, and the second and third step kind of often happen more or less at the same time. After, meanwhile, for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, ideally, there's the felt sense of being attuned to, cared about, appreciated, loved, desired, wanted, sought, included, and so forth, that one senses and intends that that experience is sinking in, thereby activating, lighting up the neural circuits involved in memory, and in ways that remain somewhat mysterious, really, really deepening the memory trace, kind of like we do if we're having a really neat moment. You know, like we've all had the moment where a little voice in our head says, remember this. You know, a sunset in Maui, wedding day, our child is born, some spiritual realization on retreat or at other times. Remember this. Register this. We're kind of intending that it go in. And then the fourth and optional step, but this is where the value really, really kind of accelerates, is to sense and intend that the current experience that's positive of being cared about, loved, attuned to, you know, prized, and so forth, is going down into and touching, you know, deeper layers of pain or deficit or wound. And the way one does that in awareness is fairly simple, particularly for people who have any kind of meditative background. One holds two things in awareness at once. That's divided awareness. In other words, one holds both a very positive experience of being cared about, prominent in the foreground of awareness, with a dim sense kind of in the background of that old place of pain. People often do this with a visual or sensate sense of it all, like golden, balming syrup coming in. You love me. My wife loves me. They wanted me to do something. Someone appreciated me. Often it's not a $1 million moment. It's just the little stuff. You know, on the 0 to 10 scale of good events, it's a 2 or a 1 or a 3. But still, time after time, we sense that it's going in like a golden syrup, a golden balm, soothing, healing, and gradually replacing old places deep down inside that have been hurt. It's a very practical way to use the memory circuits of the brain, which, as I talk about in my book, are focused on the negative. In other words, the brain has, by evolution, a negativity bias. It really is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's because in evolution, it's the negative experiences that are usually most lethally consequential for survival. You know, carrots and sticks, right? If you miss a stick, if you miss a carrot today, a pleasant thing, you probably have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, wow, no more carrots forever. So the brain literally tilts toward negative experiences. It registers negative experiences just like that. But to make it register positive experiences that are not $1 million moments, it really helps to have mindful, conscious, sustained, felt attention to the positive experience to really get those neurons firing together for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row. So we're using them by understanding what's going on in the black box here. I think this is an example of where understanding the black box has helped us break new ground. Really understanding the black box, appreciating how tilted it is toward registering negative experiences, especially in implicit memory, not so much memory for events, but more like the felt sense of living. And second, appreciating how memory works in the brain, and also how when we pair two things in awareness at once, and then when we stop thinking about them and they go back down into the memory stores to get reconsolidated in storage, that old painful experience of being rejected in junior high, or you know, rattling around like a pea in a tin can in your family for whatever reason, or whatever happened, you know, that old experience can be gradually healed and soothed and even replaced with current experiences of being cared about. One person, then I'm going to keep going, because there was a little bit of a detour, hope it was okay. For me, this whole idea of mindful cultivation is absolutely central to practice.
It's helped me to write them down every day. I have a practice of writing this.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, and then the thing to do is, of course, to register them as experiences, which I'm sure you're doing. I just wanted to highlight what was implicit in what you said. Okay? So isn't it paradoxical and kind of interesting that one of the ways to transcend the self is to initially take in self-related resources and supplies, but to do it with a clear kind of intention. Okay? So, good. Now to go one step further, what I was doing there was talking about, I would call that fairly conventional psychology. And the frame here is, all right, how do we do it? If selfing drives suffering, right, particularly in the ordinary activation of selfing,